December mid onwards, it was getting better, and from January, Kashmir was 100%, almost 100% packed. If not 100, but 80% for sure. So, since March ending, you know, due to the surge in cases across country, the tourism is coming down again. It is a huge loss for the industry.
However, Shamim and many others like him are more worried for Kashmir's health infrastructure. They fear a looming disaster if the coronavirus situation is not taken seriously.
With more than 18,000 active coronavirus cases in Jammu and Kashmir, the administration of this conflict-torn region is at a crossroads. The question is whether to impose a lockdown and face its economic consequences or endanger people and overload the fractured health sector. To break the chain of infections, the administration is trying its best. However, the people also have to act responsibly. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Coviran is inching closer to the market. The Iranian-made vaccine kick-started the third human trial phase after proving safe and effective against the virus in previous trials. The third phase will involve injecting the jabs to a statistical population of 20,000 volunteers. Developers say they're certain that the vaccine provides immunity of up to 70% against the coronavirus. But it's only after the third phase that an accurate figure can be achieved.
Already we have achieved the figures, but because we want to have more figures, so in third clinical trial stage, you have to go for more, people to vaccinate. And that's why in third phase, we include more people, like 20,000 in compared with 200 or 280 in second phase.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is in charge of Coviran's development, says it has already launched the production lines of the vaccines due to emergency.
Coviran factories are built in two phases. The first phase, which is complete and ready for use, has a capacity to produce up to 3.5 billion doses of Coviran jabs each month. The second phase, which is under construction, will produce 15 million doses per month. Both will work in full swing once we receive the necessary permits in almost 2 months.
Coviran works based on an inactivated coronavirus. Its developers say lab results indicate that it's also effective against new variants of the virus. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, each based on a different platform to immunize the human body against COVID-19. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V. Once the third phase is over, Coviran will be the first ever Iranian-made COVID vaccine that makes its way to the market. This as Iran is grappling with the fourth and most lethal ever wave of the pandemic, which has put biotech firms in a race against time to get their jabs to the mass production stage. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
While many in America are celebrating an extremely rare murder conviction for a police officer for the killing of George Floyd, demands for police reform are only growing louder. Police in the United States kill about 1,000 people every year, so there's no chance the issue will go away. This month in Chicago, the nation's third largest but deadliest city, a 13-year-old boy was killed by police even though he clearly had his hands up in surrender. Eliminating systemic racism in law enforcement and implementing criminal justice reform is being demanded in the streets and in newspaper headlines, but tax money continues to be invested in more guns and war materiel. The combined spending of America's state and local budgets on police would rank as the world's third largest military expenditure.
Last year, the city of Chicago received $500 million in discretionary spending from the first major federal stimulus package. $300 million were handed to the city's police department instead of going to build the public health systems in communities devastated by the pandemic.
That's disgusting. That's not where the CARES Act money was supposed to go. There are communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, that are not having basic needs met. while the CPD gets the newest, shiniest equipment, and that's just not right. Our demand up front right now today is to promise to have a public discussion to reassess and redistribute that money.
New President Joe Biden openly opposes defunding the police, but many hoped that with an executive order, he would at least place limits on the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. That hasn't happened. The Security Reform Policy Institute found that the flow of military gear has been faster under Biden than under Donald Trump.
Fundamentally, as in American cultures, we are reactionary. We don't like to deal with the root of a cause. What we need to do is think about why and how we can fix these solutions from a fundamental level. Education, mental health resources, and in general, affordable housing, public transportation. Anything that we can do to fix the foundational level, sure, it's going to take us longer. Sure, it's a longer process with the communities, lots more discussion, but that's the only way these problems will truly get solved.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was approved by the House of Representatives in March, but it is not expected to be approved by the upper chamber Senate. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
We don't get it!
The Mujahideen brigades held a military drill to show its readiness in fight against Israeli forces. The drill, named Effective Promise, was held in several parts of the enclave, simulating many defensive combat scenarios on the ground and sea. The drill also sent a clear message to the Zionist regime that the resistance will fight back the crimes committed against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds in light of the recent clashes in the holy city.
This drill serves as a clear message to Israel that the resistance front is ready to face any aggression. This is also a message of support to our sons in Jerusalem al-Quds, who are fighting the Zionists with all their strength.
Attending the establishment anniversary of Mujahideen brigades, leaders of Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, expressed their support to Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Jerusalem is our red line, and the Israeli regime will be held accountable for the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Palestine, and we stand in solidarity with our sons in Jerusalem and will fight alongside them at all costs.
We are all united in the face of the Israeli regime. This is a national battle, and we are all united in protecting Jerusalem al-Quds against the Zionists. The battle is not only in Jerusalem. It's underway in every part of Palestine, and we are ready to sacrifice our lives for Palestine.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured in clashes at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting "Death to Arabs" in their rally in the center of the occupied city.
The resistance here showed it won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes committed against the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem al-Quds, vowing to defend the Palestinian rights at all costs. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Israel has admitted its missile system tried but failed to intercept a Syrian missile that landed near the regime's top-secret and most sensitive Dimona military nuclear site. Tel Aviv claimed the missile had landed in the Israeli-occupied territories as a result of errant Syrian anti-aircraft fire. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz said the incident was under investigation. Experts, however, say the path of the projectile flew triggered speculation that Dimona had been the target. They added that Israel insisted to keep the incident mysterious and it had imposed its own narrative on the media.
Israel tried to keep the incident mysterious. It imposed a specific story on the media that it was a surface-to-air missile and not surface-to-surface missile in an attempt maybe to hide the identity of who's behind the attack. Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile shield has failed to intercept and down the missile.
The Israeli military said that in response to the launch, it attacked several missile batteries in Syria, including the one that fired the projectile that struck its territory. Syria's state news agency said Syrian air defense intercepted the Israeli attack that targeted areas in the Damascus suburbs. Israeli officials were angered by what happened. Avigdor Lieberman, former Minister of Military Affairs and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's rival, said the regime had no functioning government and the power of the deterrence is spent.
The missile fire was kind of a surprise even on the political level. We read Israeli official statements. They were trading excuses, like Lieberman and others. The message was strong and clear, and it has affected Israel's strategic security image. It was an incident that was seen as a response to the various confrontations between Iran and Israel. Israel is not in its best situation. Israel feels threatened.
The incident happened only weeks after Israel said it had upgraded Iron Dome in a latest step in the Mideast arms race. These upgrades included the ability to knock out threats at higher and lower altitudes, and to strike longer numbers of incoming rockets could be fired mainly from Lebanon, Syria, and the besieged Gaza Strip.
Tel Aviv has always praised its own Iron Dome missile defense system in repelling attacks, but this time it failed to intercept the Syrian-fired missile, which Israel said landed near its nuclear site, underscoring Tel Aviv's military fragility. Mona Kandil, Occupied Albire.
Pakistan has called out army to help police and other paramilitary personnel to enforce strict precautionary measures in bazaars and streets to contain what the government says a sudden surge in COVID-19 cases.
Agar humne ab ehtiyat na ki.
Prime Minister Imran Khan in a televised address warned the nation that his country may soon be facing a grim situation similar to that of India, where on an average 2,000 people die every day and more than 300,000 test positive.
I have appealed to the people time and again to follow precautionary measures. However, neither people are scared of coronavirus nor they are adopting any precautionary measures. And that is why now there is surge in coronavirus cases.
Under a new decision, Pakistan has shut down schools in regions with a surge in COVID-19 cases. All markets would be closed by 6 p.m. Indoor and outdoor dining have also been banned. Only 50% staff would be allowed to work in private and government offices, while offices would be closed at 2 p.m. On an average, 100 to 150 people die daily, while between 5,000 to 6,000 people test positive every day in 220 million populated country. So far, there are as many as 102,000 total active cases in Pakistan, while nearly 16,900 people have died since March last year. The government has warned the people to get ready to face complete lockdown of major urban centers if they do not put a mask on their faces to contain the virus.
People would die with hunger if government shuts down the cities. There would be shortage of food items like sugar, flour, and oil. What would we do then?
A survey conducted by Gallup Pakistan last month reported that 65% people believe that the government is exaggerating the threat of the COVID-19. A significant number of people suffer from allergic linked diseases such as flu, cough, fever, and asthma, and many of them die every spring weather in parts of Pakistan. However, since March last year, the medical nomenclature in Pakistan have changed, and now most of these diseases have been officially classified as COVID-19 cases under what is medically known as PCR testing system, which many medical experts believe are churning out false positive cases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Despite the lockdown and curfew, thousands took the streets in Paris to protest against the reform of the social security system. The main reform concerns unemployed people who will receive less unemployment benefits. They will suffer an average loss of 20% and some will even lose 45% of their unemployment compensation, meaning 300 euros less by month. Many will not be able to pay their rent. The demonstrators blame the French government for taking advantage of the COVID crisis to accelerate anti-popular measures.
Those who will be sanctioned by this reform are those who already suffer the most from the decrease in the work volume due to the COVID crisis. All the vulnerable workers who already lost their job and who are not financially supported by the government will become unemployed and will be affected by this reform. Yes, the government takes advantage of the crisis and pushes for unjust reforms.
Cultural workers made the demonstration very lively. They are paying a heavy price due to the outbreak of the COVID-19.
Today, people who work in the cultural sector often return to their parents and have no income anymore. Since more than 1 year, we don't work, we don't earn money, and the government does not propose any solution to us. Culture is part of the freedom of expression. Only the big shows financed by the state will survive, and the others will disappear.
Billions are given to big companies, 500 billion euros. At the same time, these companies fire workers. How is it possible that this government is making the shareholders richer instead of helping the population?
Indeed, the French stock exchange market has reached a very high level with more than 6,000 points. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well since the COVID crisis, but the majority of the population does not benefit from this. More than 100 symbolic cultural places like the Odeon Theater are occupied since weeks, with protesters vowing to continue demonstrations until their demands are met.
The COVID crisis will inevitably lead to loss of jobs for many workers. Also, if unemployment benefits are affected, these workers will be punished twice. Chris Denant, Paris.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Mm-hmm.
and a supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
When it comes to the U.S. and international troop pullout from Afghanistan, all is not as it sounds. In the latest, the Pentagon has deployed B-52 bombers to West Asia and to what it calls the support of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country. That is, if the troops actually withdraw. And even if they eventually do, reports have surfaced that the U.S. will leave over 18,000 military and private contractors and special forces in that country, putting the whole notion of a troop pullout into question. To discuss this a little bit further, first let's cross on over to Kabul and talk to our correspondent, Amin Alami, who joins us. I mean, at this point, we know what the latest is in terms of the U.S. Having these B-52 bombers on standby. Tell us more about the positioning of the U.S. and whether there's actually any movement when it comes to a troop pullout from that country, along with the coalition forces.
Of course, the top U.S. military commander here in Afghanistan just declared that the preparations has begun for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, and that American troops are going to hand over all military bases and military equipment to the Afghan security and defense forces in order to help them to fight against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban, after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. But there are doubts also here in Afghanistan about the real pullout of American forces in Afghanistan. I mean that top U.S. military and political officials have so far emphasized that they will not leave Afghanistan alone and they will support this country. It means that the Washington will continue to follow its own interests in Afghanistan via, as you mentioned, using private contractors in order to continue its military presence in Afghanistan beyond the withdrawal of military forces from Afghanistan by September this year. In the meantime, another important fact is that the Afghan government says that the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan will not negatively affect the situation, the security situation in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan's national armed troops are now enough capable to not only confront terrorist groups, but also to strongly pound their possessions across this country. For instance, I can briefly point out to the recent remarks of Afghanistan's Defense Minister General Yasin Zia, who said that Afghan military forces, mainly Afghan Air Force, are conducting heavy military operations across Afghanistan, mainly in southern parts of this country and of course in northern provinces of Balkh and Faryab, to eliminate the terrorist groups including Taliban and Daesh. But what remains as a big question is that will the ongoing political efforts lead Afghanistan and the warrior nation here to a lasting peace? Only I think the time will answer such a question.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it. That's a correspondent there. Amin Alami talking to us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Okay, let's bring in co-founder of Code Pink Media, Benjamin, from Washington, D.C., one of our guests, and also from the Answer Coalition. Richard Becker joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to you both, Media Benjamin. First to you, the U.S. and the coalition forces, the announcement has been made. Do you think that they are sincere when they say there will be a troop pullout from Afghanistan?
There are all of these plans to keep U.S. Proxy war going in a way in terms of the mercenaries who are there, paramilitary units, CIA operative, and the ability to continue to conduct airstrikes on the part of the Afghan government, which is a government that does not have a lot of popular support. So I also think it's important to recognize that according to the agreement that was worked out over a long period of time between the Trump administration and the Taliban, U.S. troops were supposed to have left by May 1st. Now, Joe Biden, as he was campaigning, knew about that agreement. He had plenty of time to make that decision early on when he came in, and instead decided to push the date back to September 11th. And while in the U.S., that doesn't seem like a big problem, on the ground in Afghanistan, I think it is, because April 24th was the date that was going to be a next round of peace talks, and the Taliban pulled out of that because the U.S. had violated the agreement for May 1st. So I think there are, as your person on the ground just said, it remains to be seen how much the U.S. is going to go through with its call to not only pull out the troops, but to stop its involvement in the Afghan war in general.
Richard Becker, you have many who are supporting this, and at the same time, you have many who are not. It's kind of reminiscent of the fact when Donald Trump announced his troop pullout from Syria, many opposition towards that and many who actually supported it. However, in this case, you're having the opposition in its variety saying that it fears it could create a dangerous power vacuum in the region. Which camp are you in?
Well, I think that the U.S. troops need to withdraw, and the mercenaries need to withdraw as well, the contractors. The problems of Afghanistan can only really be resolved by the Afghan people themselves. And the U.S. has really been in Afghanistan since intervening in 1979, before the Soviet intervention, which was 20 years later, was revealed. There's a great deal that we do not know about the extent of U.S. forces there. I think that if we know from earlier wars, Vietnam War, the wars in Central America, that there were far, far more U.S. forces in the country and in different forms, taking different forms, and with mercenary units as well, than was led on to the public in the United States. The public in the United States does not know what the role, to a very large degree, does not know what the real role of the United States was in destabilizing Afghanistan in ways that have made it very, very difficult to overcome. This is the result of the reckless, imperialist, interventionist policies and the havoc that they wreak on, that those interventions wreak on countries. But, you know, to answer your question once again, only the Afghan people can determine the future of Afghanistan. The occupation needs to end.
Okay, well, maybe Benjamin, you know, we need to discuss this because we just need to, since the U.S. opted to stay in that country for, 20 years, the longest war. And let me get your reaction from one quote that I picked from a 20-year-old veteran of the U.S. Air Force, who, by the way, is against the troop pullout. She said, "We spent almost 20 years in that country, and we have nothing to show for it. It was not a well-thought-out invasion. There was no plan to actually defeat the Taliban terrorists who go into hiding, and then they bide their time and then come back out to fight again." What do you think about what this particular veteran has said?
Well, I'd say it's even worse than that. I mean, we do have something to show for it, and that is the death of countless Afghans and the displacement of so many Afghan citizens, the death of over 2,400 U.S. troops, and the trillions of dollars that could have been spent in really helping poor countries like Afghanistan or improving the lives of people in the United States. So it's not that it's devastating the violence that we perpetrated against the Afghan people, and it's devastating for soldiers and their families. Not only did we lose over 2,400, but tens of thousands were maimed and hurt psychologically in these wars and will live forever with those consequences. So I think that we should recognize that the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan has been an absolute disaster, despite the fact that Biden wants to put a spin on it, that we accomplished our mission, which he says was to bring to justice those who attacked us on 9/11 and to make sure that Afghanistan was not a haven for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Well, the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan was supposed to bring a stable Afghan government, which it didn't do. Look at the opium production that is going on in Afghanistan today, the fact that the Taliban control over half of the territory. I mean, it has been just an overall abysmal failure.
You know, it's hard, Richard Becker. It sounds like a broken record, but then there's so many ways that different organizations, different people, different officials, common people, et cetera, who have questioned where the U.S. went wrong and what did it really achieve. One of the particular instances comes back to an investigative journalistic work that was done, which I'm sure that you've heard of it, and that was from the Washington Post, where it was said that even at some point military officials were making up their successes, and that was just to appease the public, but they knew that they had no idea what they were doing in Afghanistan. It just boggles the mind, is what I'm trying to say, as to what went wrong there. Or was that a system by design because there were some gains that were being made that we're not aware of? Is that the case?
Well, there's no question. I don't think there can be any question that when these kind of interventions take place, these really wars against other people, you know, we just have to remember the Vietnam War, and that the big scandal when Daniel Ellsberg had been on the side of the government and working for Rand Institute, when he turned against the war and released the Pentagon Papers, you know, they tried to try him for treason, the same way that they tried Chelsea Manning and might have tried Julian Assange and so forth, because they revealed the reality that these kind of imperialist interventions, wars, take place against peoples that are not understood at all by those who are intervening and who are leading those interventions. And so they construct policies which inevitably fail, except in causing, as Medea said, widespread death and destruction in those countries. This happens over and over and over again. You can see in Iraq, the U.S. claimed that they had constructed a new national army for Iraq, and we're going to be able to leave. That army collapsed. I don't think the Afghan military is doing much better. And it's not a consequence of what's going on in those countries. It's that foreign occupiers cannot do that. They cannot really construct armies that are national armies because they are really armies that were built by, constructed by, and are really led by foreign interests, in this case, Washington above all. And so it turns into one disaster after another. And it brings about a situation like today. The Taliban is a very reactionary organization. It endangers the rights of women and the public in general. But the reality is that none of this, protracting the war and the policies that go on with it, that's not going to lead to anything but more disaster.
Yeah, it's a. What I find very interesting is, Media Benjamin, that both you and our guest there, Richard Becker, mentioned the word contractors that are going to remain in that country. Well, this was a stunner, and the way that both of you mentioned contractors, in a sense, I was skimming over it, even though you made your point clear. But the stunner was when the news came out after the announcement that Biden isn't ending the Afghanistan war. He's actually privatizing it, special forces, Pentagon contractors, intelligence operatives, to remain 18,000 of them. And that doesn't sound like a true pullout. Is that figure something that shocks you? Is this something that shocks you when you hear about how many may remain in that country? According to this report, about 18,000 of them.
Yes, I think the issue is that we don't know, that there is no transparency. There used to be some more transparency, for example, about how many sorties the U.S. was carrying out. It used to be public information. But that was stopped during the Trump time, and it's continued under Biden. So we don't even know what the continuation of U.S. airstrikes are. And certainly we are never told the truth about how many contractors, how many CIA operatives, how many special forces. This is not public information. So I think the public in the U.S. is quite happy with the idea that the U.S. troops are leaving, but very few people have probably even read those reports that say, uh-oh, there's a little caveat in this, that the U.S. troops leaving does not mean an end to the U.S. engagement. But I think there will continue to be pressure on the Biden administration to stop its involvement in Afghanistan, because we won't be able to control what happens when U.S. troops have gone. And I think it will become clearer and clearer that no matter what forces the U.S. keeps there, it will not be able to prop up an unpopular, corrupt Afghan government. And as Richard said, it's not that we want the Taliban to take over. They are an incredibly regressive force. But it is just an example of how the Taliban are local people. They are not going anywhere, and they've said they will not stop fighting until U.S. forces have left. Now, they're not going to count, oh, it's just U.S. troops and it's only these other contractors. No, they're going to consider them foreign forces, and they won't stop fighting until the foreign forces have left.
You have this report by The Times, Richard Becker, that says the U.S. will maintain a that maintains actually a constellation of air bases in the Persian Gulf region, as well as in Jordan and a major air headquarters in Qatar, which would provide a launching pad for long-range bombers or armed drone missions into Afghanistan. This sounds like a broader plan, which means that the U.S. would attack Afghanistan whenever it wants, because based on the number of mercenaries, special forces, and intelligence operatives that are going to remain there, they're going to go after when they deem it necessary to kill either al-Qaeda elements or Yab Daesh there, or if it goes after the Taliban. So is this part of the bigger picture?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, we know a tiny percentage of what really goes on and how the war is conducted inside of Afghanistan. It's much more hidden than it used to be. One of the Pentagon's lessons of Vietnam was don't let people know what you're doing. So, you know, starting with, particularly with the Iraq War, but even earlier with the wars in Central America, very, very little was released by the military about what they were actually doing. And the same thing, I think, goes here. So the forces that are going to remain in the country, apparently the mercenary forces, the contractors, as well as the close to Afghanistan are all these U.S., many U.S. military bases. I wanted to add one other thing that I think is important to consider, and that is right now the U.S.'s number one enemy that it's targeting is China. Afghanistan has a border with China, a small border. Afghanistan has a huge border with Iran, another target of U.S. aggression. And so that has to fit into this whole picture. And, you know, the surrounding of China is taking place mostly in the eastern and southern areas of joining China. But the aim really is to, in the pivot to Asia, is to surround China, and the preparations for war against China are going forward.
So is that what's happening, Media Benjamin, based on what Richard Becker said there? Do you agree?
Yes, there's been an effort since the time of Obama to get the troops out of these, quote, endless wars and move towards China. And we certainly see that during the Biden administration. There's talk about getting troops out of Iraq as well. The problem is they keep getting bogged down because they don't want to leave in failure. I think the Iran nuclear deal is an important piece of this. If the Biden administration can do its job in lifting the sanctions against Iran and getting back into the deal, that can help to ease the tensions both in Afghanistan and in the Middle East. And that's something that we in the U.S. have to push this administration to fulfill its promises that it made on the Iran nuclear deal, and its promises that it made in over a year of talks with the Taliban to withdraw the U.S. presence.
Okay, we're going to end with that. Thank you very much. We do appreciate it. Amin Alami was a correspondent who spoke to us at the top of the hour. Also, Media Benjamin there, co-founder of Code Pink from Washington, D.C. And thank you, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mika Vitale, my entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Khomeini was a religious scholar and a true worshipper and servant of God. If you remember the previous episode, it was said that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was very hateful of doing mustahab or recommended acts, although they're not religiously obligatory. You also heard that he was very careful not to do makruh or disapproved acts. The acts that are not haram or forbidden but have been emphasized to refrain from. Today we are going to continue the discussion. Nafile in Arabic means additional. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, it means the daily prayers that are not obligatory and just recommended. These prayers have a lot of reward. There are 34 rak'at of recommended prayers which are performed with daily ritual obligatory ones. But on Friday, 4 rak'at are added to this number. These prayers are highly emphasized to recite as God will give ample rewards for them. However, the midnight prayer is the most important recommended prayer and has a lot of effects in both material and spiritual aspects of human life. According to the statements of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, recommended prayers somehow compensate for the shortcomings of obligatory ones. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, says in this regard, "Indeed, we have been ordered to perform recommended prayers in order to compensate for the defects of obligatory prayers." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "God said, 'Indeed, my servant seeks proximity to me by recommended prayer and deeds, and once I like him, I will be his ear that he hears with it, his eye that sees with it, and his tongue that speaks with it.'"
Thank you.
Hujjat al-Islam Rasuli Mahallati said, "As far as I remember and I have heard from the relatives and companions of Imam Khomeini, he would not give up performing recommended prayers as much as he could." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini didn't give up performing recommended prayers even when the security forces of the Pahlavi regime, Savak, intruded into his house. Late Ayatollah Tawassuli also mentioned an interesting memory. In the evening of the day in which the tragedy of Fayziyeh school happened, we were at the Imam's home. We heard that the seminary students had been beaten and the regime forces intended to come there. Late, Sayyid Muhammad Sadegh stood up and closed the door of the house. But Imam Khomeini immediately stood up and opened the door, saying, "Shall I close the door of my house while they are beating my children?" Then he stood up for prayer and, like other nights, performed midnight prayer, while every moment his house would likely be attacked. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini would not leave performing of recommended prayers even at the times that he was exhausted. Late Ayatollah Bani Fazil related a memory on this. In the first days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Qom, Imam Khomeini had public meetings from 8:30 a.m. till midday, during which he would deliver detailed speeches, so he had to go upstairs to the roof several times. One day, a few minutes before noon, the Imam's face was very tired as he was going into the room. I said to myself that this time he would have a rest, but when I followed him, I saw him performing recommended prayer of midday obligatory prayer. Imam Khomeini would observe little points even in recommended prayers. For instance, he would not forget saying, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim," which means, "I seek refuge with God from the outcast Satan." Imam's companions also say that he used to recite Surah Tawhid in both his obligatory and recommended prayers, although it can be dropped in recommended ones. Imam Khomeini would not give up performing of recommended prayers even in hot summer. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "In the blessed month of Ramadan, when the Imam would come to the school of late Ayatollah Borujerdi in Najaf for midday and afternoon prayers, he used to first perform the 8 rak'at recommended prayers of midday prayer and then perform the midday prayer itself. This was not an easy job for a fasting person of that age and in such a hot weather. Even the youth would fail to do it, but the Imam was so serious in worships." Hujjat al-Islam Sayyid Mujtaba Rudbari relates a memory. "In such an old age and during the hot days of Ramadan in Najaf, Imam Khomeini would observe the recommended prayers of Maghrib or Dusk and Isha, that is 9 obligatory prayers, whereas we as young people were expecting to finish prayer to go to iftar for breaking the fast."
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.